In England, where cheese and pickles are a lunchtime staple, cheesemaking is an ancient art. But recently, English cheese has been getting a lot of attention from scientists who want to study the microbes in the cheese. Reporter Carrie Smith recently attended a conference where scientists and farmers chewed over the finer points of cheesemaking.
The county of Somerset, in southwest England, is known for its rolling green fields, cider apples, and cheese. Cheddar was invented here, and for cheesemaker Dennis D'Amico, that makes Somerset a cheesy paradise.
Look where we are. It's hard to not be absolutely amazed by the beauty of this area. So.
Well, we're blessed with the weather, but I mean, for listeners who won't be able to see where we are, we have a beautiful view over the surrounding valleys. No evidence of cows, peculiar.
I think they're that way.
Oh.
We can find. They're not hard to find.
D'Amico isn't just a cheesemaker. He's also a scientist who studies cheese. He's recently moved to the University of Connecticut.
One of the selling points was that they had a fully licensed creamery.
D'Amico and other scientists have come to this farm because of the way they make cheese here. Jamie Montgomery owns the place.
We have been making cheddar here in Somerset for three generations. My grandfather bought the estate, including the house, here in 1911.
Cheese is just milk that's been fermented by microbes. Most cheese you buy at the supermarket follows a careful formula. First, the milk is pasteurised to kill potentially harmful bacteria, and then a few microbes are added back in to ferment the cheese. But the way Montgomery makes cheese is different. The milk is never pasteurised. All those microbes, usually killed off by the process, are still in there. It's a microbial festival. And that gives it variety and richness that pasteurised cheeses just can't fake.
That's where the artisan cheesemaker is always going to have an edge, because they're already in our milk. It's so complex.
Raw milk can contain up to 400 species of bacteria and fungi. And it's that complex community that intrigues the scientists gathered at this country farm. Scientists here have studied everything from tangy Stilton to creamy brie. Different types of cheeses have different microbial tenants, less to do with geography and more to do with cheesemaking methods. Whatever type you favour, cheese could be affecting the microbes in your own body. Our guts are teeming with bacteria that help us digest food, and the microbes found in cheese could be giving our resident bugs a helping hand. Cheese enthusiast and microbiologist Dennis D'Amico again.
There's a very good chance, much like our other, you know, sort of probiotic foods or our microbe-rich foods, that consumption of them will influence the gut microbiome and could in turn have some positive benefits.
Those gains could include boosting metabolism or stopping bad bugs from taking hold. But this is a cheese lover's speculation. The microbes in our guts and in our foods are so complex that it's hard to work out how they affect each other. Farm owner Jamie Montgomery is delighted to find that his cheese is so scientifically complex.
The scientists appear to be in agreement. They're all saying that in cheese, they're probably just scratching the surface. And I love that.
It looks like Montgomery's cheese will be safe from copycats for a while. For NPR News, I'm Kerry Smith in Somerset.
There's something of an apple renaissance underway, with new varieties promising ever more crispness, taste, even color. And these new types of apples are both trademarked and patented. That means many farmers aren't allowed to grow them. NPR's Dan Charles decided to take a bite out of the story.
On a quiet hillside in the apple-growing country of Adams County, Pennsylvania, alongside a narrow country road that doesn't see much traffic, Sydney Kuhn has set up a kind of trial orchard. She has about 30 different kinds of apples growing here.
A lot of these different rows, there might be 10 trees of this and 10 trees of that.
Oh, so it's not even entire rows of anything?
Oh, no. No.
Kuhn's family has been selling apples for five generations. What she takes to farmers markets these days is a mix of old and new. There's the traditional mid-Atlantic favorite, Stamen apples, but also newcomers, Gold Rush, Zestar, Pink Lady, plus the variety that changed the apple industry, Honeycrisp.
It's incredible that apple has such a following at this point. We probably sell two crates of Honeycrisp to the total of all the other varieties at market.
Honeycrisp came from the University of Minnesota. Apple breeders there cross-pollinated different trees, created new genetic combinations, and picked this one.
I still remember the first day that I tasted it.
David Bedford is one of the university's apple breeders. This apple, he says, was crisp, explosively crisp.
That texture was so different that I had to pause and kind of think for a minute, you know, is this good? Is this bad?
Consumers decided it was good. So good, in fact, they were willing to pay extra for it. And it dawned on people there might be serious money in new apple varieties. Now there's a race underway to create the next Honeycrisp. One candidate is another product of the University of Minnesota, Sweet Tango.
I think this one has all the potential of Honeycrisp. It's actually a child of Honeycrisp.
David Bedford says Sweet Tango has all the crispness of Honeycrisp, plus more flavor. But there's a crucial difference between the way Honeycrisp arrived on the scene and the coming out parties for Sweet Tango and many other new varieties. That difference is shaking up the apple industry. Honeycrisp, anybody could grow. You just called up a nursery and ordered your trees. For as long as the patent lasted, the nursery paid a royalty, about $1 per tree, to the University of Minnesota. Sweet Tango is much more tightly controlled. The University of Minnesota licensed it to a single group of apple growers, 45 of them, mainly in the states of Washington, Michigan, and New York. Sweet Tango apples come only from those growers, nobody else. They started arriving in stores a few years ago. This is the new trend in apples. More than a dozen of these so-called controlled or club varieties are available or will be soon. They're called club apples because you have to be part of a particular group to grow them. The apples have names like Opal, Kanzi, Ambrosia. Tim Byrne, who's president of the Next Big Thing Cooperative in Minnesota, which controls Sweet Tango, says there are good reasons for this trend. The first is quality control.
If you have one management company overseeing the whole thing, you get to select the group that you want to manage the commercialization, the growing, the harvesting, the packing.
Also, there's control over quantity. You can grow enough, but not so many that you drive down prices. Tim Byrne says clubs can organize big marketing campaigns. Nobody did that for varieties that anybody can plant.
If anyone can plant it, why would I put $500,000 a year into a marketing campaign out of my pocket when anyone else can ride the coattails of that campaign?
One more reason. These controlled varieties aren't just patented. They're trademarked. The Next Big Thing Cooperative, for instance, controls the Sweet Tango name. Unlike a patent, a trademark never expires. So Next Big Thing could have exclusive rights to sell Sweet Tango apples forever. This is the future of the apple section in your supermarket, says Tim Byrne. Apple-growing clubs will compete for shelf space.
It is going to be a world of managed brands, just like the soup aisle or the potato chip aisle or any other aisle.
Now, for a lot of people in the apple industry, this is an unsettling change. Phil Bacher is right in the middle of it. He runs the Adams County Nursery in Pennsylvania. When farmers are deciding what apple varieties to grow, they come to him to buy young trees.
We'll take a look.
Bacher takes me out to a tree-covered hillside at his nursery. The trees are filled with fruit. That row of trees on the right, Bacher says, that's a variety called Sweetie.
We can sell that to anybody.
But that one?
But that one we can't. That one only to the people that are working within the managed program.
I'm trying to figure out what this will mean, Bacher tells me. It could be good. Maybe this club arrangement can help promote new apple varieties. We've sometimes failed at that in the past.
There have been some very, very good apple varieties introduced over the past 30 years that have just never generated any real interest.
On the other hand, what if you're a farmer and your customers want some new apple that you cannot grow? This has, in fact, happened to apple grower Sidney Kuhn.
We've actually had customers at market ask us, you know, about Sweet Tango. And we explained this is a club variety. We cannot be, you know, we are not part of the club, so we cannot grow that apple.
But Kuhn says, I am not really worried. There are still lots of great apples that I can grow. And when I explain the situation to our customers, they say,
you know, Honeycrisp is just as good, so we'll buy your Honeycrisp.
But she is interested in another new child of Honeycrisp, a variety called Evercrisp. A group of Midwestern apple growers created Evercrisp, and they're managing it a little bit like a club apple, except that if you want to grow this apple, you just sign up and pay dues. This is a club that anybody can join. Dan Charles, NPR News.
David Edwards has affectionately been called a mad scientist, but what could be mad about inhalable chocolate, especially if it has no calories? Edwards is a biomedical engineer based at Harvard. He founded a lab in Cambridge and Le Laboratoire in Paris, spaces devoted to artistic and cultural experiments. He's also known for his wiki food products with edible packaging. Some of his best ideas have to be eaten or inhaled to be believed. Andrea Shea of member station WBUR does her best to explain.
David Edwards says change is inevitable. He wants to figure out a different way to deal with it.
Many of the questions that we face today, questions of innovation, of change, are not really questions that we can deal with in a classical science lab. And I think that's why cultural labs are showing up increasingly around the world. By opening the creative process up to the public, it leads to a better understanding of, you know, how the world's changing and why it's actually thrilling that it is.
That's why Edwards has been inviting scientists, designers, composers, artists, and chefs to collaborate on projects the public can experience as they're going on. This open lab, a kind of cultural research and development effort, grew out of Edwards' earlier work. The biomedical engineer helped pioneer aerosol prescription delivery systems for patients with diseases like Parkinson's. After selling his company, Edwards applied the technology and the profits to chocolate delivery and called it Le Whiff.
We've done a lot around air food and other kinds of nutritional experiences that are without calories, that are all natural, that are portable, and there's no liquid, and all kinds of benefits. That really wasn't where we were at initially. We were just sort of exploring, well, would it be possible to deliver nutrition through the air?
Or at least a buzz. After Le Whiff came Le Waff, a machine that turns liquid, quite often alcohol, into fluffy clouds of consumable gas. Boston Globe technology columnist Scott Kersner visited Edwards at Le Laboratoire in Paris.
People come in off the street and they're like, what exactly is this? Can I buy something here? And he really took great delight in explaining the Wikifoods concept. And I think he kind of does have that enjoyment of, like, you can't really put your finger on what is he trying to do and what is the point of it exactly.
Wikifoods are little spheres of ice cream, yogurt, or cheese wrapped in edible packaging. And their point is to cut down on landfill waste. In this country, Edwards is collaborating with the dairy company Stonyfield Farms to get Wiki yogurt onto the shelves at Whole Foods. Technology writer Kersner thinks Edwards' lab fills a void in a landscape loaded with incubators trying to create the next Facebook or Twitter.
If he's creating a place where you can develop a new food product or, you know, spawn some new nonprofit or some new cultural group, you know, that's a really interesting kind of incubator to me, because it's not just saying, let's create new public companies that are going to be worth billions. It's saying, you know, let's create healthier foods that maybe could be distributed without refrigeration in the developing world. And let's do cultural innovation. And not a lot of people are saying that.
The lab in Cambridge is also collaborating with MIT's Dalai Lama Center and a cartilage expert to explore how sound and vibration affect our minds and bodies.
Oh, that's the note you want to
That's composer and MIT Media Lab professor Todd Macover singing along with his piece Vocal Vibrations that he says invites lab visitors to sing and feel their voices vibrating through an egg-shaped orb.
The sense is, oh my gosh, I'm holding my voice in my hands. It's exciting to have a place like Le Laboratoire where they're willing to think about where different senses can take us and what happens if you combine them.
Which brings us to the O-Phone, a little device that transmits and receives aroma messages. Chef Patrick Campbell collaborated with David Edwards to concoct scents based on dishes he's created for Le Laboratoire's restaurant. But the no-nonsense chef admits he was skeptical.
The idea of someone sending essentially my dish across the ocean instantaneously, and there's three people in a Parisian coffee shop smelling my cavatelli or whatever it is a very interesting concept. I mean, obviously, it just makes me hungry, and if I smelt that, I would immediately want to get something to eat.
Like a lot of the concepts here, the O-Phone is a work in progress, one that visitors to Le Laboratoire can try out and even help researchers come up with some useful application. For NPR News, I'm Andrea Shea in Boston.
You know the saying, you don't ever want to know how sausage is made. Despite this sage advice, McDonald's is now sharing the nitty-gritty details of just what is in the Big Mac, the McRib, and other iconic meals. Sales have not been great, and there are all those rumors about what exactly McDonald's does put in its meat products. So they launched a PR campaign that meant going out onto the streets and asking people to ask them the tough questions. Here are a few of them.
What part of the chicken is a chicken nugget?
What's in your chicken nuggets?
That pink slime. What's up with that?
What is really in your beef?
What's in your hamburger?
Is the beef 100%?
I've read that there's horse meat in your food.
Maureen Morrison, who covers the fast food industry for Ad Age, says it's actually a tactic that's been used before and with some success.
It's just part of a larger trend of a lot of these major food corporations coming out and trying to say, hey, our food really isn't as bad as you all think it is. It's actually using real beef or real chicken, which when you think about it is kind of funny because I think we all expect to be eating real beef and chicken to begin with.
To address the persistent rumors, McDonald's has called in former Mythbusters co-host Grant Imahara, and he has questions.
Why doesn't the burger rot? Where are the bones in a McRib? Does McDonald's even sell real food? You have questions about McDonald's food, so they've asked me to help you find the answers.
In one video, Imahara visits a Cargill meat processing plant in California where he gets the VIP treatment.
Hi, Grant. Great to see you again. Welcome to Cargill. We're really excited to tell you all about McDonald's beef today.
All right. I'm eager to see some meat.
Inside the burger patty factory, Imahara asks a supervisor.
I got a lot of questions for you.
Outstanding.
Are there lips and eyeballs in there, Jimmy?
The answer, by the way, is no. It is 100% beef trimming, whatever that is. Imahara continues with some good-natured ribbing.
So you don't pour in any wood pulp or other kinds of meat?
Beef in and beef out. Nothing else is added.
Unlike Domino's, which actually admitted its pizza isn't so good after holding some focus groups, Maureen Morrison says McDonald's isn't rethinking its menu or suppliers. It's just pulling back the curtain to try to attract new customers. Because today, people want to know where their food comes from, how it's raised, and how it's processed. That means knowing how the sausage, or rather the burger, is really made.